Okay. Let's get to the subject material for this morning. Let me just remind you, quickly review where we were when we stopped on Monday. We were in the midst of looking at drugs that target the bacterial cell wall. And we had begun our discussion by looking at specifically beta-lactam antibiotics and more specifically penicillins. We looked at the four types of penicillins, and we also looked at how one can extend the spectrum of these agents by incorporating into a preparation a compound that functions as a suicide inhibitor of beta-lactamases. Now, gram-negative bacteria, if I just can remind you, have multiple beta classes, types of beta-lactamases. And these inhibitors will inhibit classes thereof. And the example that we looked at was clavulinic acid along with amoxicillin, because it is, all of these, the only orally active combination. There are others that are used. Now, what's before us today is to look at, finish off penicillin hypersensitivity, and then look at everything that remains here. We're going to deal with penicillins, individual types of antibiotics. These are all beta-lactams. Then we're going to make sense out of this collage known as cephalosporins. And then finally, we will look at two stray antibiotics, all of which inhibit the bacterial cell wall, all of which are cidal to the bug. So, we were in the midst of a discussion of the major side effects of penicillins, hypersensitivity being the main one. We looked at the three forms of hypersensitivity as a function of time: immediate, accelerated, and late. We saw these two were driven or mediated by IgE antibodies. And we saw how penicillin can isomerize and give rise to a reactive compound that can acylate or form a covalent bond with macromolecules. So the drug isomerizes, reacts with nucleophiles such as an epsilon amino group and a lysine residue or a sulfhydryl group to form a covalent bond. Now, this puppy is a protein. Onward. And that is recognized as foreign. Antibodies are produced. Some individuals produce IgE, and that leads to the development of immediate and allergic reactions. Now, the question that we stopped at was, what do you do if a person comes in and gives you a history of penicillin hypersensitivity, and penicillins are clearly the drug of choice to treat that person, such as a pregnant individual that has syphilis? Penicillin's clearly the drug of choice, clearly safe to the fetus. And now Susie says, gee, I've had some reaction antibiotics, I can't quite remember what they were, da-da-da-da-da-da, and you want to be certain that Susie is not going to have an immediate or allergic reaction if indeed you choose penicillin as the drug of choice. There are two ways to skin test. There are skin testing procedures. These are very infrequently used because normally there are other antibiotics over here, other options for treating such a case, but not always. And so in the situation where you want to use a penicillin and you also want to have some assurance that the patient is, after a verbal history, is not going to have an immediate or an accelerated reaction, there are two ways to skin test. One way is, and in fact, two substances, and these are used to evaluate a patient. Both of them are used. One of these substances, let me just slide this up for you, is called PPL or penicillin polylysine. Let me tell you what it is. You can imagine a polypeptide made up of lysine residues, polylysines, 15, 20 units of lysine that chemically has reacted with penicillin. So imagine lysine reacting with penicillin in a polypeptide where you have multiple penicillin groups, maybe 15 or 20 of these. That is the nature of penicillin polylysine that's used to skin test. The other material that's used to skin test is called, and I don't make up these names, okay, minor determinant mixture. These are penicillin breakdown products that are antigenic. These are penicillin breakdown products that react or form haptens with endogenous proteins, just as we see here. If you just allow me to show you what these are, please don't write them, okay? There is a nomenclature that has evolved in this area that speaks of major determinants and minor determinants. And what major and minor refer to is that antigen, the amount of antibody that's produced in response to that antigen. Now, don't be suckered. A major determinant does not give rise to IgE. In fact, it's just the reverse. It is the minor determinants that appear to be very important in the production of IgE antibodies and in the production of an immediate and allergic reaction. Here's what we just saw. Penicillin group onto a protein. That's what I shared with you. There are, and that's referred to as a major determinant. There are other breakdown products, and you see them here, that are minor in nature, that give rise to smaller amounts of immunoglobulins, and particularly IgE. And these are compounds where the carboxylic acid has reacted with the protein to produce a peptide or an amide linkage. Here's another one where a sulfhydryl group on the protein has reacted. Antigen, 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 that are antigens that are produced as a result of exposure to penicillins. Now, this minor determinant mixture is not commercially available in contrast to penicillin polylysine. So one is commercially available. The other, the pharmacist will make from either penicillin G, may have some of these breakdown products. Both are used in testing. Yes?
Okay. So this might be the inner biochemist I'm asking. But so to get the immune response, you have to make the covalent bond. But shouldn't you get an immune response anyway if you have the bacterial enzyme? Like, what's so special about...
Shouldn't you get the immune response?
Because it's targeting a bacterial, a foreign enzyme anyway. I mean, is there just something special about...
Oh, is there something special about these deck? Yeah, I don't know what that I cannot answer. In other words, if you think about it, such a small change you would not envision would cause such a profound effect. And I don't know what it is about the penicillin molecule that leads to this so-called exaggerated response. I really don't know. I don't think it's known. Okay. So, let me just step back to the case. Susie, pregnant, syphilis. Two substances available to skin test. If indeed one uses penicillin polylysine, right arm, I'm making this up, penicillin or a minor determinant mix, left arm, and Susie is negative to both, one can be 99% plus sure that Susie will not have an immediate or an accelerated hypersensitivity reaction to penicillins. So the bottom line is, in specific cases where penicillins are clearly preferred and indicated, there is a way for you via skin testing to rule in or rule out the likelihood of an immediate reaction. Yeah.
Is it common to use both skin tests?
Absolutely must.
Okay. Does that apply to
No, it doesn't. No. And in fact, these skin tests are fairly prompt, the response. Okay? Now, hypersensitivity or allergic reactions are the major side effects that one has to be concerned with penicillins. And having now exaggerated this a bit, let me also tell you that if you recall, that only about 2% of patients experience this. So in the vast majority of the public, or the patients you're going to be treating, penicillins can be given and given with no serious side effect. There are some other side effects, however, that you need to be aware of. And these tend to be limited to certain agents, others fairly minor, but at least be sensitive to. All the penicillins are capable of producing a nephritis. And this appears to be a hypersensitivity type reaction. And it is particularly a problem with methicillin. And the nephritis is an acute interstitial nephritis that is produced. It is reversible. And it's this nephritis that, for all practical purposes, has resulted in methicillin no longer being used. All of these compounds have the potential to produce diarrhea, particularly those that are extended in their spectrum, particularly those that are not completely absorbed. Let me give you an example. Ampicillin has the ability to cause diarrhea, and if you carry it on, result in a superinfection. It has the ability to alter or disrupt the microflora. I alluded to the fact that when you give penicillins, these are salts. They're sodium salts, they're potassium salts, and there is the possibility of cation toxicity. Excess amount of sodium, excess amount of potassium. And depending on the nature of the patient, that may be an important factor. Some of these compounds also disrupt the functionality of platelets. They decrease agglutination. You see this with some of the anti-pseudomonal penicillins, carcinogen, particularly in patients that are predisposed to hemorrhage or in patients that are receiving anticoagulant drugs. And then finally, there is a unique complex of rash associated with ampicillin and amoxicillin. These are ampicillin rashes. And these rashes have properties somewhat different from those that we described with the other penicillins. They can be urticarial hives, just like the penicillins, but more commonly and more predominantly, they are maculopapular rashes or eruptions. And they result or are produced by ampicillin with an incidence or frequency about twice that you see with penicillins. 9-10% of patients will have maculopapular rashes. And we know a bit about these rashes. We know that they occur later than penicillin urticarial reactions, typically out 6-7 days after treatment has started. We know that they occur more frequently in children than in adults, just the opposite of what we saw with penicillins. And we know that they do not have an immunological base. That is, they appear not to be a hypersensitivity reaction in the classical sense. There are no IgE antibodies. Patients that have these ampicillin rashes can be subsequently treated without consequence with ampicillin. Now, a fact that is important for you to know is the incidence of these rashes goes to about 90% when the drug is given to a patient with mononucleosis. And mononucleosis has many symptoms of a bacterial infection. And when ampicillin is administered to a patient with mono, maculopapular rashes occur to the extent of about 90% in these patients. We have looked at drugs that affect the cell wall, and specifically penicillins, sort of as an interlude before we get to cephalothrips and cephalothrips, cephalosporins. I want to talk about two individual, unique antibiotics that fall under the canopy of beta-lactams. And here's how they came about. Chemists basically tried to make a better widget. Could they make a better penicillin was the question. And so the effort was made to see if indeed you could modify the penicillin molecule in a way to make a different, a more unique, a more selective, a more specific, a less toxic drug. And one of the approaches they took was to see how much of the penicillin molecule could be chopped away and still retain the activity of the drug. And that led to a class of drugs called monolactams. They basically stripped away the five-membered ring, and one was left with the beta-lactam. And here it is. Beta-lactam with a fairly complicated substituent here. And this class of drugs is known as monobactams, and there's one drug that's commercially available. It's called aztreonam. And I'd like to just tell you a bit about this drug, and then we'll look at its cousin. This is a parenteral antibiotic. It is given by injection, and it is effective against aerobic gram-negative bacteria, especially Pseudomonas aeruginosa. Its spectrum of activity, you won't know this yet, but just write it down. It'll make sense in a bit. Its spectrum of activity is similar to that of third-generation cephalosporins, and aminoglycosides. It is highly resistant to beta-lactamase inactivation. Its mechanism of action is identical to that of penicillins, that is, it binds to the binding protein, inhibits transpeptidation. It has no cross hypersensitivity with penicillins. Stated another way, The drug does not lead to antigens capable of producing IgE antibodies. The side effects that one sees, and this is clearly dose-dependent, involve seizures, particularly in people that are prone to seizures, and leukopenia, probably as a result of effect on bone marrow. So this is, I would say, a niche drug. This is a drug that's used for seriously ill individuals, given by injection, aerobic gram negative, frequently these nosocomial injections, very limited in its use. The other variation on the penicillin theme was a compound called imipenem, and it is simply a penicillin where the sulfur has been removed from this ring system and placed on the exterior. It is a carbon analog, sulfur removed, carbon inserted. It is a carbon analog of a penicillin. It's one of a number of compounds called carbapenems, or carbon-based penicillins. It again has the business here in the form of the beta-lactam. This imipenem is also a parenterally administered antibiotic. It is packaged along with a second compound called cilastatin. And cilastatin's function is to inhibit a renal enzyme, an enzyme found in the brush border of the proximal tubules, called dehydropeptidase. And it is this renal dehydropeptidase that breaks down imipenem, leading to loss of activity in the production of metabolites that are nephrotoxic. So cilastatin is present to inhibit brush border dehydropeptidase activity, preserving imipenem in the urinary tract and inhibiting production of toxic metabolites. It has no antibacterial activity. Now, if you look to see how this, the spectrum of activity of this compound, you will see that it has an enormous spectrum of activity. This is probably the antibiotic with the widest or the broadest or the greatest spectrum of antibacterial activity. It's effective staph, it's effective, it is not effective against methicillin resistant Staphylococcus aureus. It has activity against streptococci. It has activity against Neisseria and a huge number of gram-negative bacteria as well as anaerobes. So this drug finds utility as a result of its broad spectrum in infections where you're treating an infection where you have not identified the organism, where there are multiple microbes. Valuable in nosocomial infections. It is resistant to beta-lactamase inactivation, and it appears that the primary, but not the only, mechanism by which resistance occurs to imipenem is altered porin structure. This drug, imipenem, shows cross hypersensitivity with penicillins. So it's not a drug that can be safely used in an individual that has had an immediate or allergic reaction to penicillins. The most common side effect, again, it's fairly well tolerated. It can, like its partner, cause seizures in individuals that are susceptible to seizures. Now, it should be clear, and it will become clearer in a second, that none of the drugs we have visited so far are capable of treating methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. That's going to be true of all beta-lactams. In fact, it's going to be true of many other drugs that are non-beta-lactams for reasons we know not. One of the recurrent themes that I think, or I hope you've picked up, as we've looked through penicillins particularly, is that all of these drugs are susceptible to inactivation by beta-lactamase. That by changing the R group, one can extend that spectrum from penicillin G to ampicillin to the anti-pseudomonals. But every drug within those classes is susceptible to inactivation by beta-lactamase. And thus, there was a need to come up, identify compounds that would be more resistant to beta-lactamase inactivation. Let me translate that. Would be useful in managing hospital-acquired infections. Be more effective in the treatment of hospital-acquired infections. And this led to the discovery of a group of compounds called cephalosporins. Let me just give you a bit of historical background. These compounds were first identified, the class, at the end of the Second World War. And they were identified or produced by a fungus. And the fungus was isolated or found in a sewer near a sewer outlet off the coast of Sardinia. Now, I tell you this because drug companies went on fishing expeditions. They went looking in nature all over the globe to identify soil samples, water samples, etc., that would provide leads when cultured up and grown, that would be potential leads for the discovery of new antibiotics. And so this water sample was taken and shown to have antimicrobial activity. And the antimicrobial activity was the result of the presence of a fungus called a cephalosporum, thus the name of the class. And the mold produced a number of compounds that were sort of alphabetized, cephalosporin C and N and P and so forth. And the structures of these were determined by the same guy at Oxford University that isolated penicillin. All of this happened in the late 40s, mid-40s, late 40s. After that discovery, these compounds started to really be noticed by the drug industry, and the drug industry got on the bandwagon. And these drugs, the therapeutically available drugs, proliferated like crazy. And the driving force for the proliferation was the fact that they had unique activities, increased activity against nosocomial infections. They were safe, They were effective agents. And so these I call the hamsters of antibiotics. They just proliferated, because drug companies wanted a piece of the pie. And there are many now cephalosporins that are out there for you to choose and are challenged now, and you got to be sharp the next 20 minutes or so, is to talk through and try to sort out everything that sounds the same, okay, but there are significant differences. So here's the molecule, here's the cephalosporin. And basically, it is a beta-lactam, looks like, very closely resembles penicillin. The difference is penicillin has a 5-membered ring, cephalosporins have a 6-membered ring. They have a carboxylic acid. The beta-lactam is sensitive to acid. The beta-lactam is sensitive to beta-lactamase cleavage, which makes it a dud. There are two handles in this molecule, two sites, two R groups that allow the chemist to modify the drug. One at R1 and a second one at R2. And by manipulating these, one can change the spectrum, the pharmacokinetics, the chemical properties of the molecule. Now, I didn't mention with penicillins, and let me just mention it here. All of these drugs, penicillin, cephalosporins, are made by bugs. So the bug, the cephalosporin mold, makes the compound. And then what the chemist does, he takes and chops this off and chops this off and puts on what he or she wants. So they are all semi-synthetic products. None of the cephalosporins, in contrast to penicillin, G and V, are natural. They're all semi-synthetic, with the bug doing the work and the chemist doing the modification. The mechanism of action, ditto penicillins. Function, bind to the penicillin binding protein, better known as transpeptidase, block cross-linking. As a result, cell membrane is exposed to the environment. As a result, in time, lysis occurs. So these are bactericidal agents. The resistance that one sees to cephalosporins, even though they are more resistant to beta-lactamases, again falls into the three categories. They can be inactivated by some of the beta-lactamases. So beta-lactamase inactivation is one form. A second is altered or deficient or absent penicillin binding protein. Alter the target, absence of target, the drug doesn't work. And then lastly, and this is really important now for the gram-negative, altered porin structure. So basically, bugs overcome the presence of cephalosporins in the same way that they overcome the presence or are able to overcome the presence of penicillins. Now, by way of preamble, what I'd like to do is first introduce you to the concept of generation. This class of drugs is sub-pigeonholed. When we talked about penicillins, we had the natural ones, and then we had the class two, and we had the extended spectrum and the anti-pseudomonal. Well, here the pharmacologists and the microbiologists have a different nomenclature, and they speak in terms of generation. First generation, second generation, third generation, fourth. And there are drugs in each of these generation boxes that have similar, not identical, but similar properties in terms of their spectrum of activity. And generation most simply reflects extent of gram-negative activity. So as you go from first to second to third to fourth, one is increasingly dealing with compounds that have greater activity against gram-negative bacteria. Sometimes there is a loss on the gram-positive side, but we'll see this as we play through. So what I would like to do is begin by talking you through the properties, and we'll just pick a drug as our prototype, much like penicillin G, of first-generation cephalosporins. And in many ways, these also were, the generation nomenclature was related to time. The first drugs that came out in the 70s and early 80s did not have as much gram-negative activity as the drugs that came out in the mid-80s and the drugs that came out in the late 80s, first, second, third. If we look at this diagram or this picture, let me just translate this for you. We're going to look at first-generation cephalosporin. And I'm going to try to focus, there'll be one or two exceptions, but I'm going to try to focus on the bold drugs, and that's all you have to worry about. With the one or two exceptions, I'll point them out. Now, the bold comes in two ways. It comes in a dark bold and it comes in a white bold. And that the dark black is parenteral. This is an oxymoron, but the bold white, okay, is oral. So let me just begin by talking about cephalexin. We'll use this as our prototype drug. This is an orally active first generation cephalosporin. And here's what we know about it. We know that if you take it orally, it is very well absorbed. Almost 100% of the drug is absorbed. It distributes to tissues. It distributes into body fluids. A bit erratic in terms of crossing the blood-brain barrier. Unpredictable. Would not be a choice for treating bacterial meningitis. It undergoes no metabolism, and it's eliminated by the kidneys, by glomerular filtration and active tubular secretion, just like penicillins. Now, the spectrum of activity of cephalexin involves gram-positive cocci, but you can see staph, methicillin-resistant staph, is not touched by it. Strep pneumoniae, strep pyogenes, potentially treated. And then first-generation drugs have limited gram-negative spectrum of activity. And you can remember this by the term PEC. This is simply a way for you to remember Proteus E. coli Klebsiella. These are the gram-negative drugs that first-generation cephalosporins are effective against. So if indeed cephalexin is our poster child here, we saw it was oral. You can use it to treat soft tissue infections, skin infections. You can use it to treat pharyngitis. And then there's one other drug in this class that is used with some frequency. It is a parenteral. It must be given by injection, drug called cefazolin. And it is used in pre-surgical procedures, particularly orthopedic procedures, because it has the ability to penetrate bone. And it is used, I guess you would say, prophylactically, pre-surgically. And it's also used in other surgical procedures, but that's a good indication. So if we take first generation now as our model, then what happens when you go to the second generation? What happens in going to second generation cephalosporins? In second generation cephalosporins are going to be agents that have greater activity against gram-negative organisms, and we will see also are able to inhibit other or greater number of gram-negative organisms. Let's talk first the spectrum, and then we'll talk about the individual agents. Basically, these compounds still have some activity against strep. They have activity against Neisseria gonorrhea. And in terms of gram-negative side, they pick up three other organisms, and you can remember this now by Henpeck. So Haemophilus, Enterobacteria, and Neisseria. That ought to be easy for you to remember. So if we just look at what are the important drugs? This is clearly a judgment call, but what are the most commonly used drugs within this second generation box? One drug that is orally active is a drug called Cefaclor or C-Clor. It's been used to treat otitis media, Haemophilus influenza infections in children. It's been used to treat strep, otitis media, strep pneumoniae. It's in pediatric cases. It's also been used in adults. So C-Clor is an orally active second generation cephalosporin. And then there is a derivative, an orally active form of a drug called cefuroxime that can also be given orally and is used to treat respiratory infections, upper otitis media, etc. Then there are a couple drugs that are given by injection. One of these is a substance called cefoxitin. And cefoxitin, in addition to having this gram-negative spectrum of activity of second-generation drugs, is particularly effective against Bacteroides fragilis. So it's used in the treatment of abdominal infections. It's used in the treatment of pelvic inflammatory disease, abdominal sepsis, etc., caused by Bacteroides fragilis. What you're going to see as we progress, with proliferation became shades of gray, one drug differing from another just in shades of gray within this box. And then cefuroxime is another parenteral, it's also available in an oral salt, parenteral form of the drug, has a little longer half-life in the order of 4 to 6 hours. It does cross the blood-brain barrier, so it has been used in the treatment of central nervous system bacterial infections and is particularly effective in upper respiratory infections, particularly in elderly patients. So these are the primary drugs, oral, parenteral, second-generation cephalosporins. If one now tries to improve on this, greater activity against gram-negative pathogens, differing improved pharmacokinetic properties, one sees that when one goes to third-generation cephalosporins. One picks up a few more organisms And unfortunately, we pick up a few more drugs. So, in going to the third generation cephalosporins, what you have is you have greater activity against gram-negative, but you also, with certain of these, pick up a troublesome organism called Pseudomonas aeruginosa. So there's activity against Pseudomonas aeruginosa in the third generation agents. Let me talk first about a minor drug, but it has a niche. There are a couple orally active third generation cephalosporins. We'll just pick one. Cefixime is a third generation orally active cephalosporin that is finding use in single dose treatment of Neisseria gonorrhea patients. Cefixime. There are a number of drugs for treating gonorrhea in a patient. Compliance is tougher than nails. An orally active one-time under supervision is about 97-98% effective in the treatment of Neisseria gonorrhea, even Neisseria that's producing beta-lactamase. If one goes to cefotaxime, this is a parenteral drug. And the key feature of this drug, other than it has great spectrum of activity, is its ability to diffuse across the blood-brain barrier, achieve effective levels in cerebrospinal fluid, be life-saving in bacterial meningitis. It's also used in a variety of infections peripherally. Cefotazidime is, within this group, the most active against Pseudomonas aeruginosa. So if indeed you had a patient in the hospital with Pseudomonas and you were going to choose a cephalosporin and a third generation agent, this would be the drug that one would choose. And then finally, a drug you may know of as Rocephin, ceftriaxone, is a third generation. This is probably, I'm generalizing, but it's probably the most widely used of the third generations. It has many, many uses. It has a long half-life, so it does not require as frequent dosing as some of the others. It crosses the blood-brain barrier, so it enters the central nervous system. It's highly effective in the treatment of Neisseria gonorrhea. Here's the problem. You got to give it by injection parenterally versus cefixime that you can take orally. That translates into cost. And the other interesting feature of this drug is the fact that it is primarily, in contrast to the vast majority of cephalosporins, this drug is primarily eliminated in the bile. So it becomes a drug that can be used in a patient that has a nosocomial infection caused by one of these organisms that has decreased kidney function. Those shades, those subtle differences, I guess they're not. Differentiation markers for these drugs. It also is able to get into bones. So this has fairly wide utility. And so chemists said, okay, can we make a better cephalosporin? And so they have come up now with, and you can see this is a minor drug, cefapime, a fourth generation, and all this drug is it's a parenteral drug with much greater activity, less drug required, bacteria more sensitive against gram-negative pathogens. There's really, I have taught this so many times, and I must tell you, I've tried 86 different approaches to make this Gerber's. There's no easy way to teach these because they all sound the same. And so I have great sympathy for you, and I hope this is clear enough, emphasizing just the biggies, okay, here to get a hand. What you will do as a doctor of tomorrow is you're going to get comfortable with a few of these. You're going to use these, depending on your practice, the nature of your practice, you're going to become comfortable with these and you're going to know them in spades. This is just a generalization. Let's take a break and then we'll start up in a bit. Okay, we're ready to pick up the story. We've looked at cephalosporins. We've looked at the various generations of cephalosporins. Let me just remind you that none of these cephalosporins are effective against methicillin-resistant staph. None are effective against enterococci. None are effective against mycoplasma or chlamydia infections. So although they have a broad spectrum of antibacterial activity, there are still some holes remaining in terms of the organisms that can cause disease. Now, one of the things that we need to at least address is, sure. Methicillin-resistant staph, enterococci, chlamydia, this is a stress test, okay, and mycoplasma. Now, mycoplasma is a no-brainer if you don't know this. They don't have a cell wall, so none of these drugs are going to be worth diddle against mycoplasma. Okay, the question now is, okay, if this is the spectrum and these are such wonderful drugs and they have been massively used by the medical profession, what are the risks associated with their use? And the first one that comes to mind is, what is the risk of an allergic reaction? And more specifically, what is the risk of cross-hypersensitivity with penicillins? Well, the incidence of hypersensitivity reactions, and this is really fuzzy, is about 1 to 2%. So 1 or 2% of patients will have some type of a hypersensitivity reaction. Individuals that have experienced hypersensitivity to penicillins will have an increased risk of hypersensitivity to cephalosporins. Approximately 4 to 5%. So the question then becomes, okay, if 95% don't, can you safely, what are the risks associated with using a cephalosporin in a penicillin hypersensitive patient? Let me just add one caveat. Cephalosporins do not give rise to antigens like penicillins. They do not isomerize. They do not react in the same way. So the question is, can you safely give a cephalosporin to an individual that has had a hypersensitivity, we're general now, reaction to a penicillin? And the answer is yes, with one exception. And the exception is, you would never give a cephalosporin to an individual that had an immediate reaction to a penicillin. That was a very, very small percent, if you recall. So cephalosporins now have increased activity, have orally active, decreased risk, and that was used to promote the use of these drugs, and doctors went bananas, using these drugs widely, somewhat indiscriminately, and somewhat excessively. There are two other side effects that are worth mentioning, and these are associated with select cephalosporins. And you say, which are the select? There is a member of your class that pointed out to me that I failed to mention what these little triangles were. One, two, three. These are compounds. These are cephalosporin preparations that at R2 have a substituent, okay, have an organic substituent that makes them capable of causing the next two side effects. So the next two side effects that we're going to talk about are only seen with cefamandel, cefotetan, and cefalparazone, because they have this R2 group that leads to these side effects. Well, what are they? We're going to talk about this side effect with not just cephalosporins, but others. And that is, they have the ability to inhibit the metabolism of alcohol. And they inhibit the metabolism of alcohol at the second step. They inhibit aldehyde dehydrogenase. And they inhibit aldehyde dehydrogenase, and so if Jocko is on a cephalosporin and goes out drinking, he will become sick as a dog and vomit, vomit, and vomit some more. Now, that needs to be communicated to Jocko if you're going to give one of these cephalosporins to treat his whatever. Okay? Now, that response is the same response that you see with a drug called disulfiram that's used to treat alcoholics. Alcoholics have a choice. Go to the slammer, go on disulfiram. Okay, I'll take disulfiram. If they go on disulfiram and drink, bingo, bingo, and vomit. Okay? There are drugs that act like disulfiram, and these cephalosporins are three. Now, these cephalosporins that have this R group, this complicated R group, also are prone to produce hypoprothrombinemia. That is the result of decreased production of vitamin K microflora of the intestine. One can reverse this, it's a reversible effect, by giving vitamin K to the patient. So these last two side effects one sees only with the cephalosporins that possess the R group at R2 that is associated with them. Maybe I need to reorient you now here as to where we are. Here's where we are. And here's where we're going. We've dealt with all of the beta-lactam antibiotics. We've dealt with the beta-lactamase inhibitors. And now we're going to look at two drugs before we wrap up the cell wall as a target that are individual drugs that work to inhibit cell wall synthesis, but they do it at different places in different ways and have different properties. And one of these drugs one of these drugs is vancomycin. And this is an important drug. This is the structure of vancomycin, and vancomycin is a very complex glycopeptide made by a bug to kill, to inhibit, to impair other bugs. It inhibits bacterial cell wall synthesis, but it does so by a completely different mechanism than the beta-lactams. And here's how it works. The target of this drug is an enzyme called peptidoglycan synthetase. Vancomycin inhibits this enzyme. And let me show you where this enzyme functions in the scheme of the synthesis of the cell wall, and then tell you how this takes place. Let me just refresh your memory here. This is the second stage of the synthesis. So this is the phospholipid carrier taking muriatic acid pentapeptide, making the glycosidic linkage, attaching the glycines, and now taking the repeating unit and chop and connect, moving it from inside to out and attaching it to an acceptor site where cell wall synthesis is taking place. This step is catalyzed by peptidoglycan synthetase. It is a transglycosylation step. So it is really two steps, snip, attach. Vancomycin inhibits this step and thus inhibits cell wall synthesis at this stage. Bug can't make cell wall becomes defective, cell membrane, you get the story, it kills the bug, it's a cidal agent. It works by binding to the D-alanyl-D-alanine tail. And as a result of this glycopeptide binding to this D-alanyl-D-alanine tail, sterically distorts this molecule such that the enzyme cannot carry out its snip-attach steps. So for the drug to work, the bug must have D-alanyl-D-alanine as its tail to a natural amino acid couplet. As this drug has been used strategically in clinical situations, and increasingly so, organisms, reports of resistant organisms have begun to appear. One mechanism by which bugs beat vancomycin, there may be others, okay, is by changing, whoops-a-daisy here, by changing the D-alanyl-D-alanine tail, the sensitive prerequisite, to D-alanyl-D-lactate, and the substitution of lactic acid for a D-alanine results in decreased affinity of vancomycin for this versus this, and therefore decreased inhibition of peptidoglycan synthetase. Let me say something about its pharmacology, and then we'll talk about why this is a life-saving drug. This is a drug that is given intravenously. One exception, and I'll point it out at the end. It undergoes minimal metabolism, 90 to almost 100% of the drug will be excreted unchanged by glomerular filtration, and will be eliminated with a half-life of about 6 hours. Its clinical spectrum is gram-positive cocci. And here's why it's such an important drug. It's useful against staph and read this baby, including methicillin-resistant strains. So now here is the first therapeutic agent that is effective against multiple drug-resistant, methicillin-resistant staphylococcus. It's also effective against multiple drug-resistant streptococci, and strep pneumoniae increasingly becoming resistant. And it's effective against enterococcus. So this is the first drug that became available and why it is increasingly being used to treat methicillin-resistant staph. Just as a diversion, there was an article in the newspaper this morning that I thought would be interesting for you to see. U.S. deaths from deadly resistant staph may surpass AIDS. This is in the United States. This is not Africa, okay? This is in the United States. So you get some idea of the magnitude of this problem in the United States. And we could talk about all of the efforts that are being made to control this organism by screening patients, by screening hospital visitors, by screening staff, to knock this down. But I thought it was a pretty profound headline. Okay, so here are the organisms. There's one other use for this compound. And, Judas, I don't have it here. Okay, I'll draw it for you. You remember we talked about antibiotics altering the microflora. Antibiotics altering the microflora and giving rise to superinfections. And we said that one of the organisms that lives in the intestine that can overgrow and lead to a superinfection is an organism called Clostridium difficile. And this organism produces an exotoxin. And it is the exotoxin that Clostridium difficile produces that leads to colitis. This can be life-threatening. The exotoxin leads to the production of pseudomembranes on the mucosa of the large intestine. If not treated, can lead to perforation and potentially a fatal outcome. One treatment of Clostridium difficile colitis, Clostridium difficile infection in the GI tract, is to give vancomycin orally. It is not the first choice currently. The first choice is to use a drug that we will visit in about three lectures called metronidazole. It's not because metronidazole is better. It's because one wants to preserve the activity of vancomycin for these multi-drug resistant strains. Okay, what are the risks associated with the use of this compound? It is given intravenously, and depending on the rate of intravenous administration, it can lead to fever, it can lead to chills, it can lead to a flushing, it's basically a histamine, massive histamine release, vasodilation, resulting in a red face or a red man syndrome. It can lead to phlebitis at the site of injection. So the effects appear to be primarily but not exclusively allergic or hypersensitive in nature. All of these can be managed with pretreatment with various compounds and by slow intravenous administration of the drug. These side effects, the flushing, the chills, the vasodilation, can be attenuated down. Not eliminated, but become less severe. At high doses, vancomycin can also cause a nephrotoxicity, that is, it can damage the kidneys. This is dose-dependent, and it is reversible. And at high doses, it is also capable of producing an ototoxicity. That is, inner ear toxicity affecting both hearing as well as balance function. And that, too, is reversible in the patient. So it comes with some baggage, but the baggage clearly is not so severe as to negate its use in a life-saving manner for the treatment of these infections. Now, let me tell you the problem. This is a setup for a week from today. The problem is, as the bug sees more vancomycin over and over again, vancomycin has selected out for bugs that are resistant to it. And now we have vancomycin-resistant staph. We have vancomycin-resistant strep. We have vancomycin-resistant enterococci. Now we're getting between a rock and a hard place in terms of therapeutic agents that can be used to treat. Let me dim the lights. I'm used to being in the dark, I think, here. Okay. Let's turn to another. This is now a cameo drug. This is a minor drug, but I want to mention it for the sake of completeness. Because you're going to encounter it. You've already encountered it. You just don't know so. This is a drug called bacitracin. Bacitracin is another compound that inhibits bacterial cell wall synthesis. It's a polypeptide antibiotic. It was isolated from a wound in a young girl by the name of Margaret Tracy. That's where it got its name, in the late 40s. And its spectrum of activity is gram-positive bacteria. And let me show you how this compound interferes with the ability of the bacteria to synthesize cell wall. It, too, functions at the second stage, at the level of the phospholipid transporter. And here's where it functions. This compound inhibits the enzyme, a pyrophosphatase enzyme, that cleaves the pyrophosphate to the monophosphate. It inhibits this step in the synthesis of the cell wall, the result being the decrease or a decrease in the amount of functional transporter available to transport the repeating unit from inside to outside. So bacitracin blocks this pyrophosphatase enzyme and as a result inhibits cell wall synthesis. The enzyme has a fancy name called bactoprenol pyrophosphatase. I said that this is a drug that's used to treat gram-positive infections based on its toxicity, based on the availability of much more potent, effective drugs. Its use is very limited, and here's how it's used. It is used topically. So you see it in lotions, salves, creams, drops, whatever. You see it in triple antibiotic for scrapes, or various preparations because it is effective topically against gram-positive organisms. And that's where it's used. That is, we're not done for the day. Don't misconstrue this, okay? That's the end of drugs that affect the bacterial cell wall. These are the home runs, okay? This is the ultimate in selective toxicity if you're not hypersensitive. Now we're going to move one notch in, and we're going to look at, this will be painless, I assure you, okay? We're going to look at a drug that functions to inhibit cell membrane of bacteria. Now you see there's a couple other drugs listed here. These agents screw up cell membrane function in fungi. We'll deal with those later. But there is one drug that's used to treat bacterial infections and that functions at the level of the cell membrane, and this is polymyxin. And so what I'd like to do is describe how it works, and then we'll describe how it's clinically utilized. This is the structure of polymyxin. And just to point out a couple features of it, because it'll become important in terms of its mechanism of action. It is loaded with dibasic amino acids. Diaminobutyrate, diaminobutyrate, diaminobutyrate. So it has a very positively charged hydrophobic component. And then it has a tail here that's made up of a lipid moiety. So let me draw you an artist's conception of what this molecule looks like. This is basically polymyxin. There are a number of polymyxins that have been isolated from an organism, polymyxin A, B, C, D, E, it's an alphabet. The one that's used clinically is polymyxin B. And this is what it looks like. We saw it was a cyclic polypeptide made up of dibasic amino acids that under physiological conditions are going to be protonated, so it has a positive head. And then it has also a hydrophobic component in the form of a lipid. So this tadpole is positively charged with a lipid tail. And that's going to become important in terms of its mechanism of action. And here's what we know about polymyxin B. It is only effective against gram-negative bacteria. And the reason is only gram-negative bacteria have an outer membrane, and it's the outer membrane with which polymyxin B interacts. And so then the question becomes, okay, how does it do it? And here's what we know. So polymyxin B only works against gram-negative bacteria. We said gram-negative bacteria have this outer membrane, and associated with this outer membrane are these lipopolysaccharides that have cationic, particularly divalent cationic binding sites. So just imagine, let me draw you a picture since I'm in the drawing mode. An artist, I am not, okay? So if this is the outer membrane, and there are these. Okay. And associated with the lipopolysaccharide are sites that bind divalent cations, i.e., negatively charged sites. These negatively charged sites attract the positively charged polymyxin. So if you just allow me, so electrostatically, the positively charged drug binds or is attracted to the negatively charged lipopolysaccharide binding sites, and then the lipid-rich tail intercalates into the outer membrane. And when that lipid-rich tail intercalates into the outer membrane, it disrupts the outer membrane. The integrity of the outer membrane is compromised, destroyed. It becomes leaky. So the primary attraction, let me see if I can do this in a pretty way. The primary is an electrostatic attraction, and then the lipid tail intercalates into that outer membrane, disrupting the outer membrane, and that then allows the drug to get to the inner membrane, and I don't know if it interferes with the inner membrane. But what we do know is it is the explanation for why only gram-negative bacteria are effective and not gram-positive. It is also the basis for why this drug is particularly effective against Pseudomonas aeruginosa. So it has gram-negative activity, Pseudomonas aeruginosa in particular. And this is the mechanism of action. Well, how is it used from a clinical point of view? Think about it. This drug functions at the level of the membrane. Bugs have membranes, you have membranes. There ain't much difference between a bacterial plasma membrane and the plasma membranes in your bod. The chances for selective toxicity are near zero. Therefore, when it is used parenterally, systemically, it is a highly toxic drug. So its use is, like bacitracin, restricted to topical use. And again, you find it in topical salves, creams, drops, ointments, typically in combination with other drugs. I've now laid out two for you. Bacitracin covering positive, polymyxin covering negative. A third component, which we'll get to in about a week, is a compound called neomycin that's also frequently in this gamish. Bacitracin, polymyxin, and frequently in Neosporin, for example, okay, you will have neomycin as the third drug.
Yeah. Is this considered bactericidal?
Yeah, it's cidal. Absolutely. Good question. It kills the bug, okay? Now, if you say, how does it do it? I don't think the precise mechanism, other than perhaps loss of integrity of that outer membrane starts a cascade and the inner membrane gets compromised and the cytoplasmic contents get released. I don't know that for a fact.
Our membranes and their membranes are very similar, but we don't have LPS.
No, I understand. I understand. It still interacts with the plasma membrane and disrupts it probably through the tail, through the lipid-rich tail, okay? There's always somebody that screws me up. Okay, I was trying to explain why it's selective for gram-positive and gram-negative, and that's the explanation. But it's clearly, it has significant effects on the nervous system. Okay? Now, one last thing. This is the benediction for the week, okay? And this is a setup for next week and next week and next week. Here's where we are. And we have one other subject to just visit briefly. We've looked at drugs that affect the cell wall. We've looked at a drug that affects the cell membrane. Now we're going to move into the cytoplasm of the cell. When you get into the cytoplasm of the bacteria, there are many potential targets. And the place I want to just introduce is protein synthesis. Protein synthesis inhibitors represent a huge number of antibiotics. Okay? And so what I'd like to do is introduce the subject of drugs affecting protein synthesis and simply look at the first objective here, and that is, can we describe or can we explain how bugs make proteins and how it differs from you? In other words, there must be differences that are exploitable in order to achieve selective toxicity. Because if there isn't, these are not going to be useful agents. So what is it between bacterial protein synthesis versus host protein synthesis that appears to be the basis for the selective toxicity? Well, protein synthesis that we're going to be focused on is going to be restricted not to transcription, but to translation. All of the drugs that we talk about are going to be drugs that in some way inhibit translation of the message into proteins. And as you know, this takes place at the level of the ribosome. This is the structure on which or at which protein synthesis takes place. And if you just allow me to review, and this is not for memorization, okay? The difference between a prokaryotic and a eukaryotic ribosome, you're going to see some differences, and that's going to become important in what we're going to be explaining. So here's a prokaryotic ribosome, and it is made up of two pieces. It's called the 70S ribosome. It's simply a measure of its size, its sedimentation rate. It's made up of two pieces, and ribosomes are made up of RNA and proteins. That's the two building blocks, or those are. So if you dissociate this, you can dissociate it into a larger piece, a 50S subunit, and you can dissociate it into a smaller piece, a 30S ribosomal subunit. And then if you sort these subunits apart, if you subdivide compositionally the subunits, what you see is the larger, or the 50S, is made up of two species of RNA, a 5S and a 23S, and a collection of proteins. And the smaller unit is made up of a single species of RNA and about 21 proteins. So various species of RNA and various proteins go into making the two subunits of the prokaryotic ribosome. If we look at the same picture now in the eukaryote, you see it's a larger ribosome, slightly larger, that can be dissociated into two pieces, a 60S and a 40S. And then if you subdivide these pieces, you have three species of RNA plus about 50 proteins. If you do the same thing for the 40S subunit, you have about 30 proteins in a single species of RNA. Here's the point. There are structural, compositional differences between the eukaryotic and the prokaryotic ribosome that are going to lead to differing affinities of antibiotics for these ribosomes that will lead to selective inhibition of protein synthesis in one and not the other. Or, putting it another way, my out, the basis for the selective toxicity, is going to reside in differences in ribosomal composition that lead to differing binding. So if that's where it happens, Then the question is, how does it happen? And we will visit this multiple times over the next week. But one can break this process into three steps. The process of translation. The first step is putting the machinery together, and that's called initiation. The second step is the carrying out the synthesis of the protein, and that's called elongation. And the third step is the termination. And so if we just look, having looked at the ribosome and knowing what is required, the process of putting the machinery together to carry out translation involves binding of the 30S to the messenger RNA. And there are various initiation factors or binding factors that play a role here that's not critical for us. So the message binds to the 30S ribosomal subunit, and that is followed by the introduction of the N-terminal amino acid. The activated N-terminal amino acid gets introduced, and in this case, it's N-formylmethionine. So the transfer RNA interacts with the start codon, and the N-terminal amino acid gets introduced, and that is followed by the attachment of the 50S ribosomal subunit, so now one is good to go. The unit has been constructed, the messages and subunits have been constructed. The message is attached, the N-terminal amino acid is in place. Then if you look at the process of elongation, because this is really where we're going to be focusing almost exclusively, you can look at this ribosomal subunit and at least conceptually identify two sites. There is an A site, the site of decoding, the acceptor site, the amino acyl transfer RNA entering site, and there's a P site, a peptidyl site, the site to which the growing peptide is attached. So if one now is going to carry out protein synthesis, the N-terminal amino acid is attached, the A site is vacant, a codon is exposed, and the appropriate amino acyl RNA that can interact with that codon is introduced at the A site. And then this is followed by the formation of a covalent bond between the amino group at the A site and the acyl group at the P site. And this peptide bond formation, bing to bing, leading to the peptide bond, is carried out by an enzyme called peptidyl transferase. It's one of the proteins that makes up the 50S ribosomal subunit. Peptidyl transferase carries out the formation of the peptide bond. Transfer RNA is released from the P site, and the ribosome ratchets or notches or migrates one step up or translocates, with the peptide now being translocated to the P site, a new A site exposed. In the process continues and continues and continues as amino acids are introduced after amino acids until a termination codon appears here to tell the process to stop, and at that point the peptide is released, the amino acyl group or the transfer RNA is released, the subunits dissociate back into the gamish of the cytoplasm. We are going to be looking at drugs predominantly that bind to one or the other of these subunits. Some that bind tightly, some that bind reversibly. Some that are bacteriostatic, some that are bactericidal. They are going to bind to, and I'm generalizing, okay, areas of the 50S or areas of the 30S subunit in a way that protein synthesis is inhibited. inhibited because the aminoacyl transfer RNA cannot be introduced, inhibited because peptidyl transferase cannot carry out peptide bond formation, inhibited because the growing or the ribosome cannot translocate down the message. And that's where we will pick up the story on Monday, 8:05 or thereabouts, and look at the drugs that affect protein synthesis. Oh, absolutely.
What was the term you used for the bleeding disorder you get with decreased production of vitamin?
Hypoprothrombinemia.
Hypo?
Hypo, okay. H-Y-P-O, pro, P-R-O, thrombinemia.
Okay.
It is the result of vitamin K deficiency and can be overcome by given vitamin K.